Hello, I'm Nathan Kling. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of RSL Care South Australia. I've been with the organisation for 5 years, prior to which time I did 23 years in the regular army and still are a member of the Army Reserve, but have been CEO for RSL Care for the past 4 out of those 5 years while I've worked for the organisation.
And what is RSL Care South Australia?
RSL Care South Australia is predominantly an aged care provider. We're very much in the veteran space. We've been around for over 100 years. We actually started as an organisation back in 1915 looking after homeless diggers returned from Gallipoli. Now, South Australia, as a small community, had a large number of troops ashore in the Gallipoli campaigns. And about halfway through the Gallipoli campaign, a number of those sort of wounded and damaged troops started to return to Adelaide. And of course, back then, there weren't the services to look after them. There weren't homeless services. If you were homeless back then, you were a swaggy. You just sort of slept rough. And so our organisation actually started walking along the banks of the Torrens where the soldiers, the returned soldiers, had set up a bit of a camp on Pinky Flat just down from the Adelaide Oval, and started supporting the soldiers in that location with food parcels and care parcels and things. And then in 1917, we purchased the Myrtle Bank Farm because it was realised that the numbers coming back were quite large and the need for that support was very real. So some money was raised and we purchased the Myrtle Bank Farm and we moved our first residents in there on the 24th of March in 1917, which were 26 veterans that moved in. I'm smiling to myself. I read the minutes of the first meeting of the Myrtle Bank property, and in the minutes of that first meeting they described those first residents as alcoholics and no-hopers. Such was the vernacular at the time. Look, I think we can forgive them because it's really quite an innovative program that they'd started back then, because no one was providing those sorts of services. And what it really eventuated into was a very affirming peer support environment where soldiers lived with others who shared the same lived experiences that they did. They were required to contribute to their existence, so they had to go out and look after the chooks and keep the gardens and keep the veggie patch. We had a crabby old matron, and I use that term affectionately, who lived in the front room and kept the blokes honest and off the grog as much as she could, and helped to look after them as they looked after themselves. And so as an organisation, you know, our roots trace back, right back to that support to veterans. And I'm really proud to say that, you know, since that 24th of March 1917, there has not been a single day where there hasn't been a veteran being cared for at our Myrtle Bank site, which is now called the War Veterans Home. So for well over 100 years, you know, physically we've had veterans in our care in that location. The type of care's changed, the veteran populations have moved through. At one point we were a tuberculosis hospital. We've been a repatriation hospital. So everyone talks of the repat in Adelaide as being, you know, the repat at Dawes Park. But in fact, Adelaide's had 3 repat hospitals. One at Keswick Barracks, which was the first one, which opened in 1911. There was ours at Myrtle Bank, which was a repatriation hospital from 1919 to 1926. And then, of course, the repat hospital at Dawes Park, which opened in 1942. But for our part of that history, we were initially a homeless program. We were the tuberculosis. We were under the repatriation commission. Then we went into sort of a genuine hostel environment. They said, oh, we'll probably be able to shut up shop about 1950 with the needs that they thought we'd have. But then, of course, World War II happened, and that next population of veterans moved through our care. And still are moving through our care. We've still got World War II veterans in our care very much today. And now we're finding that those next generations are starting to move through. So as an organisation, RSL Care started, you know, really in those very early days, but we've now grown to be an absolutely contemporary provider of residential aged care. We've got 2 facilities. We've got the War Veterans Home at Myrtle Bank, which is a 95-bed facility, and we've got Moreland Court, which is a 61-bed facility at Angle Park. The Angle Park facility is really quite important because the local government areas surrounding Angle Park represent 4 out of the top 5 population centres for veterans in South Australia. So it's a very veteran-dense area, and to have a veteran-focused facility in Angle Park that is able to sort of address that smack bang in the middle of that high-density veteran areas is something we're really quite proud of. We've just renovated the facility there, actually, which is great. So that residential care space is very much our bread and butter, but on top of that, we also do retirement living. We've got 4 retirement living villages, 3 located in Adelaide and 1 located in Murray Bridge. And then we also run a homeless veteran program for contemporary veterans, working age veterans. There's a bit of an awkward terms around that. Increasingly, I am hearing the term referring to the current veterans as being sort of Gen 4 veterans, the fourth generation veterans, so sort of first generation being sort of the Boer War and the World War One, second generation sort of being our World War Two, third gen being our Korea, Borneo, Vietnam, and then our fourth generation veterans being our Timor, Rwanda, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Bougainville, that sort of cohort. I don't know if that term will stick, but it seems to be the best one I've heard so far to describe them. Homelessness is a big part of our operations too. So as an organisation, we're a not-for-profit charity. We've got a volunteer board. Our mission and objects are all very much linked around providing those accommodation services to the veteran community. But like any community provider of aged care, we are open to the broader population. You know, if you're a Catholic provider or a Lutheran provider or an Italian provider, you'll have a density of those populations in your facilities, but you are open to the community, as are we, in both of our residential care sites. So that's us in a little nutshell.
In a nutshell, it's been a long journey.
It has for the organisation. You know, I guess it's been a long journey because the history of our returned troops is a long journey. You know, the history of Australia fighting above its weight and committing troops around the globe. We've done that from the Boer War right the way through, and we've cared for every one of those generations. And the need remains. We've got work to do. Even if in the globe we don't fire another shot in anger from this point forward, we'll be dealing with returned servicemen and women for the next 90 years. You know, these are the troops that are currently overseas now. These are the troops that are currently in places like Iraq and Afghanistan or have deployed and will deploy again. Let alone for any conflicts that inevitably will happen going forward. So very much got our eye on what our current role and mission are, but also our role and responsibility to evolve to help meet those growing contemporary needs as those populations change.
And with those four generations, each generation would have had specific needs. How are you coping with that, and how have you coped with it in the past?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because we've had the benefit of seeing those veteran populations move through our ranks. There's a couple of things that we find are fairly consistent amongst the veteran population. The first one being they come into our care young. The forward edge of each of the veteran populations are pretty beaten up. Now, that's not to say that there aren't veteran examples in all of those cohorts that have thrived, done really well, have had post-traumatic growth after their military experience and gone on to do amazing things in the community and live very long, happy lives. But for each of those populations, there is a forward edge that has struggled. Often they struggle with mental health, often they struggle with social issues, often they struggle with substance abuse issues. And so what we find is a fairly consistent theme is that as they did in 1917, the first populations that come to us are quite young. And for the World War One and World War Two veterans, the first populations we looked after World War Two came to us quite young. But equally, we've still got, I'll use the term back end, the longevity in the World War II veterans. We've got veterans moving in to us still who are 100 and walking in for their first experience of residential care because they've had a great life. They came back from the war and had healthy family, had healthy social engagement, made healthy choices, lived active lives, and that's how they've made it through to 100. Whereas, you know, for example, we're now looking after Vietnam vets in aged care, and the forward edge of that Vietnam vet population is starting to move through our ranks. I've personally dealt with Vietnam veterans who came into our care at age 50, at age 65, at age 67. So that's that forward edge element. The average age of a Vietnam vet from a service pension perspective in this state is around 72 years old. And the vast majority of Vietnam veterans are out having great lives, grey nomading, hanging out with the grandkids, volunteering at the RSL, being involved with the VVF or the VVA, socially engaged with their communities. And the vast majority will come into us as normal residential aged care residents. In the aged care industry, the average age is 84.6 years. So we wouldn't expect to see most Vietnam vets until at least that age, and we'll have Vietnam vets walking in at 100, like we do with the World War II guys now. But the forward edge does struggle, and the forward edge does need care younger, which is why we've got 16 Vietnam vets amongst our ranks now who need that support, who don't have that social connection to help with their care, who have a range of comorbid issues, physical issues, some with physical injuries from their service that have then echoed into their older years to make it difficult for them to live at home alone. Some have got mental health issues, some related to their military service, some not. Some that deal with substance abuse issues, which then creates a range of other social and comorbidity issues that make it difficult for them to sustain themselves safely and comfortably at home. So we do find that, again, like World War One, like World War Two, the forward edge does move in quite young, and also we find that that population will be moving through us as an aged care provider for around 30 or 40 years. So we'll look after the forward edge veterans now, and then 30 plus years from now, the 100-year-old veterans will be walking through our door. Of course, it won't be the same veterans year on year. They will rotate and turn as life goes on. But we're very much setting ourselves up as an industry provider, very firm in the knowledge that for the next 30 years, we've got a cohort of Vietnam veterans coming our way that will have a completely different experience in aged care to what their World War II veteran family had. And in some ways, it'll be a tougher experience for the Vietnam vets. The industry's improved, absolutely. The aged care industry is getting better every year, no doubt. Even with things like the Aged Care Royal Commission that's going on at the moment, that will see continued improvements in the aged care industry. So the Vietnam vets, like any of the baby boomer population, will benefit from those improvements. With World War II, Australia deployed 993,000 people, nearly a million people, to World War II out of a small population base. So if you take those million veterans and you add on their partners, husbands and wives, well, there's 2 million people that were directly affected by the war. As those 2 million people moved through into aged care, classically through those years, they were cared for by, and this is going to sound like I'm being sexist, but the reality was they were largely cared for by the daughters of that generation in the industry. That's what it was through the 70s and the 80s. Nurses and care staff were predominantly Australian-based ladies whose father, uncle, grandfather went to the war. So as an industry, we had a large veteran population in the industry, and also we had a large amount of personal knowledge and understanding amongst the care staff about what that means to be a veteran, to be a veteran family, to have served overseas, even though they might not have got all of dad's stories or granddad's stories. The empathy was there to understand it. What will be different for the Vietnam vets is we didn't send 993,000, we sent 60,000 from a much bigger population base. So the density of Vietnam vets in the normal broader population is much, much less. And that same density flows through into aged care. So we won't have 20 World War II veterans in a facility of 100 anymore. We'll be lucky in a facility of 100 to have one Vietnam vet. For a normal facility, RSL Care is different. We have a high density. If you are the one Vietnam vet in Port Pirie, for argument's sake, you may be the only one in that facility. And Port Pirie facility is great, care is great, service is great, but the veteran culture, the veteran understanding will be very difficult to maintain. And that couples with the fact that a lot of the care staff now in our industry actually come from overseas. They're excellent carers, really smart men and women, really caring, great at their jobs, haven't got the first clue about the Vietnam War, don't understand about conscription, don't understand about Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War because their countries weren't involved. So it wasn't part of their history growing up. It wasn't part of their experience. So when they come to work in our country, they come to Australia and they work and they choose the aged care industry and they provide great care, if they're dealing with that one Vietnam vet in Port Pirie or Port Wakefield or wherever you might be, their ability and their natural instinct to understand that veteran's culture and their background will be diminished versus the care platform we had for our World War I and World War II populations who were cared for predominantly by Australians who lived through those wars, either as children or to see the echoes of it afterwards. So it's something in RSL Care that we're really conscious of in terms of making sure that the industry can properly meet the needs of veterans going forward, because I think the industry in the past has just relied on the fact that there were so many World War II veterans, that everyone knew what World War II was, and that the care staff naturally had a bit of an affinity and an understanding of that. My concern is that as an industry, we'll continue to think it'll be okay when in fact it's going to be very different for the Vietnam vets. The level of care absolutely will be better. It'll be better than what we were doing in the 80s, which is better than what we were doing in the 50s. So we have continued to evolve and improve as we should as an industry, but buried inside that are those sort of cultural cues, the need to understand what does it mean to have post-traumatic stress disorder? What does it mean for an older person to have PTSD? And what does it mean for maybe a Vietnam vet who has coped pretty well with their PTSD through life because they've maybe stayed active and that was their coping mechanism? They walked the dog, they played tennis, they played golf, they went to the RSL, they had social connections. As they've gotten older and their hearing's dropped off, their eyesight's faded away, they've got type 2 diabetes, they can't drive anymore, they've had a foot amputated as a result of their diabetes. All these issues that come into play that mean they can't do the things that they used to do, certainly as well, that help them cope with their PTSD. So often then that black dog can circle back around. They've kept a lid on it with all of these strategies through life, but those strategies as a coping mechanism aren't available for them as they hit some of the frailties of age. So how do we help them reframe that? How do we help them understand or find new ways to manage those same stresses that have always been there as an underlying issue for them, that they've self-managed, but now some of those strategies are gone. How do we put new strategies in there? And how do we help the industry understand that? Now, I think the aged care sector is actually really good at managing some aspects of mental health, such as dementia. But if I was to have a criticism of our industry, I think that this really comes down to government funding and government recognition. It's almost as though conditions of mental health are expected to be left at the door. You don't have anxiety in aged care. You don't have depression in aged care, post-traumatic stress disorder. All these factors that are just factors of life that go right through our lives, they don't stop just because we turn 84.6 years old. They were there when we were 84.5 years old, and they'll be there when we're 84.7 years old. But the industry, for example, isn't funded to help provide support around anxiety or depression or things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And because our Vietnam vets won't be there in the kinds of numbers that we had before, I think that the veteran populations in aged care used to peer support a bit. There would always be a group of old blokes down the hallway having a chat. There'd be a billiard table down the end. They'd all sit around it, probably not playing billiards, just chatting. They'd catch up for a beer and a smoke at the end of the day. None of these things are going to be options in normal industries. We have a pool table and we let the veterans, we smoke, so we're a bit different. But how will the industry respond? Who is banging the drum now about looking after Vietnam vets in aged care? At RSL Care, we're trying to beat it fairly loudly, but there's not a lot of people jumping on board with this. I'm not hearing that drum beat out of DVA. I think DVA is genuinely very, very concerned about veterans of all ages. They've put a lot of effort into managing the transition of Gen 4 veterans out of the Defence Force and into work environments once they separate. Well, I see this as another transition, another critical transition for veterans. Yep, we transition out of the Defence Force into other jobs. We transition from those jobs into retirement, and then we transition into what we'll call sort of that aged care bracket, be that at home, be that in an aged care facility, or be that under some other form of care arrangement. How is, for example, DVA changing to help meet that transition? At the moment, we largely drop the veteran at the door from a DVA perspective because it's funded federally under the Aged Care Act. So as a veteran community, we couldn't say where all of our veterans are in aged care. Well, why not? Why don't we know? We'd know if they're in a tertiary hospital. We know if they're in an acute inpatient hospital, yet we don't know if they're in an aged care facility. We should. Here in South Australia, I go to a DVA forum run by Janice Silby, who's the Deputy Commissioner for DVA SANT. She does a brilliant job. And in that really useful forum, a lot of people attend. We go through the complaints of veterans in the public hospital system. So if a veteran goes into, for example, in our state here in South Australia, into the Royal Adelaide Hospital and makes a complaint in the emergency department about wait times or services or something, well, DVA find out about that. They put that complaint on the table. And then we discuss it. We understand the problems. We see if there's some sort of influence. And DVA are really committed to that. It's a great program. But we don't track veteran complaints in aged care. I'd argue that's our most vulnerable veteran population in the land are those that are in aged care. I've got veterans living with us now that will be dead tomorrow if we don't do our job well. As an aged care industry, we have a complaints commissioner. So in my head, well, why aren't we identifying at that point if someone's a veteran and if they have a complaint and that the complaints commissioner then can deal with organisations like DVA to say, look, we've got a problem concerning a veteran in Dubbo or in Mount Isa or in Augathella. And all these little small regional places where there'll be one Vietnam vet with an issue that needs help but gets lost in the aged care sector. So I think there's a real opportunity for us now to change how we manage that, to look at the problem a different way, to generate some really efficient solutions. It's all going to be paid for somehow, so we can't be silly with it, but I don't think we'd need to change much to build a system that is ready for the Vietnam vets. So as I mentioned earlier, the Vietnam vets are 72 years old, roughly now. The average age in the aged care sector is 84.6 in residential care. So we've got the time between Vietnam vets being 72 now and turning 84.6 years to sort this out. So we And the sad thing is already we've got Vietnam vets in aged care, though, who aren't benefiting from this. So, you know, we need to act now so that we can evolve the industry to meet those needs so that as the bulk of that population starts to move through, we've got some of these questions answered. We've got some of these support mechanisms in place. If we wait until that population reaches that average age bracket as a mass cohort, I mean, of course, there's 95-year-old Vietnam vets at the moment because they were regular soldiers or sergeants or warrant officers in Vietnam. But if we wait till they hit the industry en masse, it'll be too late because it'll take us 4 or 5 years to change, 4 or 5 years to update legislation, 4 or 5 years to get it through Parliament, all the things that need to happen to make sure we look after them, and we'll miss the boat.
Is part of the answer to that being able, firstly, to identify those veterans when they actually enter the aged care system?
Absolutely. Point of entry at all levels of life's interaction for veterans is so important. I think in our state here in South Australia, we've worked closely with SA Health to do point of entry in the public health system. At RSL Care, with our work with homeless veterans, we've worked really hard to get veterans as an identifier on the homelessness gateway, which is the services that if you're homeless, you have to go through the gateway to then access homeless services. So there used to not be a veteran drop-down box, well, there is now, so that we can identify and track veterans and know where they are in the system. And then people know to ring us. You know, they might not necessarily look at a 34-year-old woman and think she's a veteran. And she wouldn't necessarily think to suggest that she was either because she left the Army 10 years ago. But without identifying, I think there's an opportunity with the aged care sector to do exactly that. You know, have at point of admission into an aged care facility, not only did you serve, but what was your service? Actually taking a military history, understanding a veteran's service, what unit were they in, what service were they in, what corps were they in, where did they deploy, how long did they serve for? These are really easy questions that, for example, organisations like mine would happily provide a template around, because I get that, you know, a Catholic service in Tanunda may not have the vernacular to ask the sorts of questions that those of us in the veteran space can ask and understand. They wouldn't know what a corporal or a sergeant was. They wouldn't know what an engineer or an aircrew member was, but we do. And we can provide those sort of templates for them to be able to gather a bit of that as important social markers for the veterans that come into the industry. But certainly as a start point, and I think it's probably, you know, DVA in my head are probably the biggest chance we've got to succeed there, to really advocate for that. And in my view, to actually put some resources into the industry to help providers ask those questions. Because it is a big ask for a little provider to be able to understand and ask those questions. So let's tool them up. Let's skill them up. Let's provide the training. Let's provide the resources. And then let's get that national database so that we do know where our veterans are. You know, our veteran population in Australia now is somewhere around 641,000 people. DVA know where those are that they deal with from a residential postbox perspective, but we really struggle to understand who is in what facility where. And a lot of the veterans in aged care facilities are just below the radar because they're now under the federally funded system. They don't have any direct contact with DVA, haven't done for the 2 years they've been in aged care, don't have a big family network around to visit them and support them. They drop off the radar of their support networks. I was at Manum RSL only a couple of weeks ago. Great RSL down on the river. And they're explaining to me the challenges they have when one of their members has to move to the city, being Adelaide, for care. They wind up in aged care and then move from one facility to the next and get completely lost to the RSL membership there. So they don't know where they are to go and visit them. They can't find them. But yet they've got members that would happily call in and say good day if they were doing the shopping in Adelaide or something like that. So there's that kind of visibility aspect, which certainly has a big part to play in then how we then help and support those veterans once they're in aged care. But if we don't know we're there, well, that's clearly the starting point.
Do you see that there are definite health benefits in being able to mix with others from the veteran community?
We see some very good outcomes. And there's not a lot of research in the aged care space, but there is a lot of research we can draw on from sort of working age veterans, particularly out of the States, but also some good stuff out of Australia. That shows the impact on what is increasingly being understood as well-being. You can actually be physically quite unwell, but still be quite well within yourself, socially connected, happy with life, resilient in terms of your personality and your resources, and still having quite an active existence, even though you might have a crook back or a sore knee or a bung hip. Now, what are the ingredients that go into well-being? It's really important that the social map of you is full. If we were to look around the outside of our social map, you know, we've got family, we've got friends, we've got the need to be needed, we've got the need to be heard, we've got some really great things like volunteering and what that brings in our social map, supporting someone, being supported, loving, being loved, physical contact, intimate contact, all of these things that sort of fill in the social map of us. What can happen is someone ages, their worlds can shrink. Some of those community networks can drop away. They can't drive to their club anymore. They may outlive a number of their really close friends and family if they happen to live to an older age and become isolated that way. You know, if you want to have a big funeral, don't die at 105. That's the reality of it. As people's social map starts to get more gaps, a big part of what we look to do around a veteran's well-being is how can we fill in those gaps that are important to them? As veterans are coming, so we have marvellous family networks, beautiful sons and daughters, grandkids, visit every week, get regularly out from the home to go shopping and birthday party. Great. It's okay. That's not a bit that we need to fill in. Where are the other gaps? Some studies from 2017 revealed that about 40% of aged care residents across the board don't get visitors at all. Now, that doesn't mean they necessarily have to be socially isolated. They're living in a great community, a fun community, a friendly community, a social community. So it might not be their family network, and there might be many reasons for that. Just because someone's old doesn't mean they're nice. You know, if you weren't a very nice person at 40, well, you know, you might not be a very nice person at 80, and often in those circumstances, their family and social networks can drop away. But there is that opportunity within the aged care industry to meet a lot of those sorts of needs. When we're looking at how to keep veterans well in aged care, there's obviously the physical care aspects, but there's very much that sense around their well-being. And for us, you know, a key area is, for example, understanding post-traumatic stress disorder. We know the prevalence in the Vietnam vet population. We know the impact around things like family networks and substance abuse. We know that that then generates outcomes which are creates environments where they can be more socially isolated. We know that they can have different triggers that we need to manage. Now, all of that knowledge helps us to modify our behaviour as a care provider, not modifying the resident's behaviour, the veteran's behaviour, but modifying ours towards them so that we learn what their cues are, we learn what they're comfortable with. We've got a veteran who spent a lot of time working night shifts and after hours in his post-military life. He wakes up about 4:30 in the afternoon and he spends the night awake in the facility. Well, okay. Yeah, we used to have to try to do his med rounds at 9 o'clock in the morning. Well, we don't. We'll do his med rounds at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when he wakes up. So how do we change our behaviour to meet their needs? You know, how can we help our staff understand that it might be a bad idea to approach a veteran from behind and startle them? Their startle response is quite pronounced in someone with PTSD. Okay, well, how can we then approach a veteran? You know, when we're having a meeting with a veteran, it can be as simple as positioning ourselves away from the entrance to the door. A veteran might even often realise the stress that they feel if they feel they're boxed in. But if there's a clear path to a doorway, even often if they don't quite recognise it themselves, it just makes for a more relaxed setting for them. So we don't stand in the doorway, we knock, we ask to come in, we move ourselves out of the doorway and then talk to the veteran at the foot of their bed so they can see us and we're near their feet and they can still see a pathway to the door, even if they're bedbound. But little things like that that we understand about the stresses and anxieties. How do we know that? Well, we've learnt as a provider, we've got experience. Our care staff are brilliant. They learn, they interact, they take records, they watch, they observe. They try things. Sometimes it doesn't work, so we try something else. When something works, we write it down. When something doesn't work, we write that down too. And each veteran's different, so there's not one rule that applies for all. But also we've gone out to experts in post-traumatic mental health. Really, we've invited them into the aged care industry. In our case, it was an organisation called Phoenix Australia, who really are the centre of excellence for post-traumatic mental health in Australia. We had a conversation with them and invited and encouraged them to help us learn, which they did. So they came and ran trauma-informed care training for our staff so that the care we provide is trauma-informed. So we understand post-traumatic stress disorder. We understand the impacts of trauma through life. And it might not be veterans. The reality is that 70% of people who make it through to 90 have had trauma in their life. It may not be war-related. It could be a house fire. It could be the death of a child in a car accident. You know, it might be the 92-year-old lady that was a rape victim at 18. You know, all these things that we might not know about but then present as trauma experiences in a resident's life, that we need to modify our behaviour to help manage that in aged care. Trauma-informed care training is an example of what we've done to teach ourselves, and not only ourselves but the industry, because we then invited other industry providers to come to us to be trained in that. Because we're only a small provider, we can't possibly care for the 60,000 Vietnam vets, and they'll be cared for by other providers. So we actually invited them to come to us free of charge to attend the full-day seminar, to learn about trauma-informed care. And in fact, we had a really great response, including clinical management staff from the public health sector. So SA Health sent staff to us to do that training, which was run by Phoenix, to understand the impact of trauma in a person's life and to then enable trauma-informed care within our industries. These are some of the areas where I think organisations like Open Arms could really assist the industry. Open Arms has got demonstrably good capacity in terms of delivering training and supporting organisations like ours. And in fact, through our partnership, they paid for the training that we delivered. And they said, no, we see what you're doing. We like what you're doing. We know you've paid for it already, but we're going to give you money for that. And we'll cover that cost because that's really important. So I think those kind of relationships are there where we can lever off existing infrastructure and experiences like Open Arms, like DVA, like Phoenix Australia, and then generate those outcomes to help the industry respond to a much smaller but no less important need as our Vietnam vets move through the industry and as our World War II veterans leave the industry over the next 5 years.
RSL Care South Australia were invited to make a submission to the Aged Care Royal Commission. What was your input to that and how was it received?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. When the Royal Commission first kicked off, all aged care providers were invited to put in a response. Quite a number chose not to because it creates risk. You needed to put in what you did well and what you didn't do well. So some providers chose not to do that, chose not to take up the invitation. We did. We said, yep, we think we can do better in these areas and here's the things we think are doing really well. And as part of that submission, we were also able to provide sort of our comments on the industry and where we think the industry could improve. For us, our focus was very much on veteran care because that's our jam, that's our gig, that's what we do. And we know that no one else is really talking about that at the moment. So we made a big focus of our initial submission on that. Fast forward to effectively 12 months of the Royal Commission doing its thing. We then received a call back saying, look, we read your submission. We're going out to a number of providers and we're asking them about veteran issues and we'd like to talk to you. He said, great, we'd love for that conversation. They came out and they said, we'd like to talk to some of your veteran residents. By all means. So they spoke with three of our veteran residents. And then through that process of interviewing us as a provider and our three veterans who are in our two facilities, the Royal Commission then made an approach for us to go and provide a formal submission to them around the issue of special needs groups. So under the Aged Care Act, there's a number of special needs groups. There's CALD, so the culturally and linguistically diverse groups. There's LGBTI, there's Indigenous, and there's veterans. So all these are identified special needs groups under the Act. And for the October hearings of the Royal Commission, which were held in Melbourne this year, they were looking very much at the issue more broadly of special needs groups. So RSL Care, we were invited to go along as a provider of care under a special needs banner, in our case, veterans. So we could have been an LGBTI provider or a CALD provider or an Indigenous, but they invited us as a veteran provider. As part of that process, you were invited to put in a, I say invited, it's a cute term. Now, you actually get summoned in the end because it's a court hearing. It's a proper court hearing. You are going to court. It's very formal, very important. So as much as they invited us, I did receive my summons. And on the back of my summons, it told me that if I didn't do this, I'd get 6 months jail. If I didn't do that, I'd get 12 months jail. If I didn't do this, I might get 2 months jail. I added all those up and all up, I was up for 12 and a half years jail if I didn't do it quite right. So there's an element of risk for us, but we happily took it because it's an important message to get up. So we made a submission of 13,800 words to the Royal Commission around a whole range of veteran issues. And then from that very detailed submission, the Commission formed its opinion they needed to interview us. So we went over. I was interviewed as CEO and then one of our residents, Brian Lynch, who's a Vietnam veteran, was interviewed for the lived experience as a resident because he's been to two providers, a provider that wasn't us in regional Victoria and then us. And so he's had 5 years in each. So he was able to provide some examples of his own between his experiences in the aged care sector. Going to the Commission, obviously it's a lot of work and it's difficult. And you know, there are providers who choose just to keep their head under the parapet so that they don't have to go and do that effort. They don't have to do the extra work. They don't have to face that risk. Because if you're in the Commission and you say something wrong, well, you're on the media and it's pretty brutal and you can find yourselves in a difficult situation. But the board of RSL Care believes absolutely in our mission, you know, believes in our objects around veterans. Our board really understands the need for us, even as a small provider in South Australia, to take a lead in helping the industry and the country to understand that there is this thing called veterans in aged care. It is a changing and evolving need. As the baby boom has come through, that needs changing as a World War II veterans go. But that doesn't mean it's any less important. You know, I did actually get asked by one of the lawyers for the Royal Commission if I thought that veterans still needed to be identified as a special needs group. Well, absolutely they do. And you know, the mere fact that was asked showed me just how much work we need to do to make sure that the Vietnam vets don't fall under the radar. We looked over the top of the Vietnam vets when they came back from the Vietnam War. We didn't give them a welcome home parade until 1987. My real concern now is that we're looking over the top of them again in our quite honourable desire to help the working age vets, the contemporary vets, the Gen 4 veterans, veterans of my era. I'm 45. You know, in our desperation to make sure we do the right thing by them, I really feel like we're looking over the top of this really important transition for our Vietnam vets. And really, it's the Vietnam vets that have laid the foundation that contemporary vets like myself are able to enjoy because they did the hard yards through the 80s and the 90s and they changed the systems. So the baby boomers have changed everything they've touched. The Vietnam vets are no different. Baby boomers are changing aged care now. That's no different. The Vietnam vets are part of that population. We're getting the transition bit for the younger veterans pretty good now. We'll always need to work at it, but I really applaud DVA for the work they've done, for the research they've commissioned, for the smart researchers that are kicking around the country, for the way that the ADF handles its people through the transition process now. Now, I've got nothing but praise. People can still flick through the cracks and there's still a few issues. We'll always need to tweak it and evolve it as generations change. But we do a really good job, I think, in that space. I do think there's a chance for us to maybe put a spotlight in this bit of a shadow, the aged care element, where we really need to make sure that we're doing the very best by our veterans of all ages and that we don't forget them just because they're in a residential care facility somewhere.
Oh, absolutely not. Age brings with it a whole new set of stresses to lives. Now, you're opening up a new facility up at, is it Murray Bridge?
Yeah, we are. So the board had a look at what we can do as a provider. And again, we're only a small provider, so we've got the 95 beds at the War Veterans Home in Myrtlebank and 61 beds at Moreland Court in Angle Park. We're very conscious of the complexities of being a veteran requiring care in a regional setting. We do have some homeless accommodation that we operate in places like Wallaroo, so we do have a bit of a regional footprint, but it is very difficult to manage and maintain. But the board's 10-year strategic plan very clearly stated that we wanted to improve the umbrella of support we can provide in regional South Australia. We'll never be a big enough provider to cover it all, but what can we do? So as part of the 10-year plan, the board made an application to the government to receive bed licences because the government controls the bed licences. It's a really competitive process to get allocated bed licences. You're up against the big boys and girls of the industry who've got 12, 14, 28, 30 residential care facilities, thousands of beds, and then there's little old us. You know, I'm aware of one provider that has 500 residential care beds in one location. You know, we've got 161 in total spread across Adelaide. But anyway, so we threw a hat in that ring and gave it a shot, and we were successful. So we were allocated 72 beds by the government. They said, yep, we can see what you're doing. We can see that you're a special needs provider. We agree that there's a need in that Murray Bridge area. It's underserviced for residential care. So we received those 72 beds. Of course, that comes with it, the responsibility of now building a facility and delivering that service. We've got until April 2023. That's when we're looking to open the facility by Anzac Day 2023. The facility will be called Romani after the Battle of Romani. Romani was fought by the Australian Light Horse in World War One. The Light Horsemen, particularly the 3rd and the 9th Light Horse Regiments, they were composite regiments with WA and Tasmanian and Victorian troops, but predominantly South Australian and predominantly country South Australians. There was a fairly heavy drought on in 1914, so a lot of the bush lads came into the city for work and joined the army to go to war for a bit of adventure, but also for work because no one was ploughing and there was a drought on. And of course, a lot of the country men could ride. They were great horsemen. So they naturally found themselves in the light horse, which were mounted infantry. They weren't cavalry, as a lot of people think, but they were mounted infantry. And then they found themselves in some really complicated fighting scenarios. So the 9th Light Horse deployed to Gallipoli, about halfway through the campaign. Everyone knows about Beersheba and the role the Light Horse had at the charge of Beersheba, but Romani is perhaps a lesser known battle, but still 146 Australians died in that battle. So it's really important for us or care, we feel, to remember some of the lesser known battles, which is, for example, why we've got Moreland Court, which 30 South Australians died in that battle. Maybe not a big number, but I always think about, you know, John Saddington Sage, who was a young fellow from Port Lincoln. He was 21 years old and he died in that battle. Well, we should remember that. We'll always remember the Kokodas and the Long Tans and the Gallipolis. But as an organisation, we'd like to memorialise in our own little way some of the lesser known ones. So Romani for us in Murray Bridge, a really important mission. enables us to provide a great umbrella of coverage into the Murray lands. So if you're a veteran in Tailem Bend, well, we can't put a facility in Tailem Bend, but you don't then have to be in Adelaide. And your son or daughter who's still on the property can come and visit you in Murray Bridge versus having to go from Tailem Bend to Adelaide. So there's that mission support that we can do out of that community, hopefully then servicing a large part of the Murray lands. But there are a lot of veterans and some great RSLs, the Murray Bridge RSL, the Tailem Bend RSL. We've got the Manham RSL, we've got Renmark. There's some great communities in and amongst those areas that will benefit from this facility. And also the connection that we're able to maintain then with the Romani name and the history. We haven't designed it fully yet, but already the facility is shaping where we'll look to memorialise the light horse through the facility. And I can kind of picture that, you know, through the gardens we might have hitching rails and old saddles and just really remembering the history of the light horse, which was only a very small number of the troops that deployed, but an important part, particularly for rural South Australia, an important part of that history that, yeah, we're going to look forward to really honouring that and seeing what we can do in that Murray Bridge facility once we get it up and running.
Well, you share our sentiments exactly for those smaller battles that aren't commemorated to the nth degree, such as Anzac, Gallipoli, Longtan, etc. One thing that you did mention was a homeless facility.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, so we operate a homeless service. We've got 48 units. We're not funded by anyone. They own the units. We don't receive community housing grants or anything. It's just a mission that the board's taken on, recognising that there is a need to support homeless veterans here in South Australia. Recent studies from Uhuru, identified that veterans are at greater risk to homelessness than the broader population, which is quite surprising, really, when you think that the pathway to homelessness normally starts maybe at 10 with a really complicated childhood and an experience of substance abuse and in and out of homes and things, and that's often how mental health, that's often how people find themselves in homelessness. Veterans don't have that experience. They might have had a hard upbringing, as a number of them have, but they've had a job. They've been to work, and the fact that we still have such a high occurrence of homelessness amongst the veteran population is a real marker of concern for us. So the board, a number of years ago, said, right, well, what can we do about this? How can we support this? So we started what we call our Andrew Russell Veteran Living Program, or ARVL. Andrew Russell was a sergeant in the SAS regiment who was killed in Afghanistan. Andrew was killed on the 16th of February in 2002, and he was the first Australian combat casualty since Vietnam. And he was an Adelaide boy. His parents, Bob and Jan, still live here in Adelaide. His dad, Bob, was actually a Vietnam vet. So there's a family that's given a lot to our nation. So we worked in with Bob and Jan Russell, Andrew's parents, and Kylie and Lisa. Kylie, Andrew's widow, and his daughter, Lisa. In part, memorialise Andrew's service by naming the program after him, but more importantly, taking his example as a really capable, competent, lovely bloke from Adelaide who went off to do his bit. Had a great career, did amazing things, became a sergeant in the SAS, and ultimately paid the ultimate sacrifice in service of his country. So through Andrew Russell Veteran Living, or ARVL, through ARVL, we operate these 48 units, but in particular we've got 10 units that are at the really sharp end of intervention for homelessness. So those 10 units we operate really are looking at, you know, pulling people out of cars who are homeless, taking people out of prison who are released on parole. We've had a number of veterans who've come to us on home detention. They're eligible for home detention, but they've got no home to go to, so they've been stuck in prison. So they've been able to come and do their home detention with us. Veterans are overrepresented in the incarcerated population beyond what we represent in the normal population. There's about 3.25% of Adelaide's current incarcerated population are veterans, which is a startling number, really. So that, you know, there's that aspect of the need. And equally, we find a need for veterans, for example, who are in the Jamie Larkham Centre and don't have a home to go to. So SA Health can't discharge them to homelessness. So how can we support someone who's got mental health issues in that space? There's a whole range of different sort of upstream issues that result in someone being in a situation where they're actively homeless. And through our program, through those 10 units alone, we've provided over 10,000 nights of accommodation to Gen 4 working age veterans here in Adelaide. So it's quite a nifty little capability. We're quite proud of those 10,000 nights. We've provided a lot of support. We've changed some lives. We haven't always succeeded. It's a pretty complicated end of the gene pool to be operating in. There's some really difficult socioeconomic substance abuse issues. And ultimately, you know, we are an accommodation provider. We really look to then work with other service providers like Open Arms to then provide some active inreach to help manage some of the social and mental health issues that a lot of these homeless veterans experience, both men and women. About 10% of the people who've come through our homeless program are female veterans, so they're not all about the blokes. If I could wave a wand and fix one thing in that sphere, it would probably be substance abuse with ICE. That's becoming a really prevalent issue for our younger veterans. It's a mongrel drug. It is vicious. It changes personalities. It changes lives. I can deal with an alcoholic. Someone on ICE, there's just not a conversation you can have. Nothing else matters to them but either getting the next hit, or the fact they're coming down off a hit, or the fact they're in an episode because they've had a hit. None of those options are good. It's a really complicated environment to be in. And we are starting to see veterans now who've had quite a good military career and quite a pronounced operational deployment history, but we've now got enough years where they've been out, where they're now facing 5, 6, 8 years of substance abuse, where that's really starting to have a chronic impact on them. You know, yet they're only 38 or 42. So how do we help resolve that issue? The reason we started this program and what we want to do is have an intervention for someone who's, say, an alcoholic or having substance abuse issues at 43, so they don't move into residential care with me at 70. I want you out at 70 with your grandkids, playing tennis, doing the Udnadatta track. Don't want you in residential. I'll be happy. We'll look after you if you need it, but we don't want you there. We want you out living a social and active life. Now, if you've had a history of social isolation, substance abuse, alcoholism, drugs from the time you were 35, well, you're going to be in care with me at 70 and you're not going to make it to 80. And I can't fix you there. I can help you. I can care for you. I can give you a good quality of life. But it's really difficult once that injury is done and you've got an acquired brain injury through alcoholism. I'd much rather we go back and help the 40-year-old prevent that and then enjoy all those years between 40 and 70 where they live a good quality of life, relevant to them and what they want to do. So that's a real focus of ours through ARVL. And it absolutely feeds into that picture of what it means to be a well veteran. We firmly believe that housing first is the solution to many of the more complicated problems we face for veterans. If a veteran doesn't have a house, how do you fix a substance abuse issue? If a veteran can't take a shower, how can they get a job? If a veteran doesn't have a roof over their head, how can you expect them to be able to turn up to counselling sessions with open arms when they're just worried about where they're going to sleep that night and what they'll eat? So we really think there's a housing first component that needs to be addressed, and we see that as our mission. So that's our piece of the puzzle, that bricks and mortar bit. And then we can then look for organisations like Open Arms, like DVA, like the RSL, like the Plimpton Glenelg Veterans Centre, like Payne and RSL, all these other groups that are doing all this great little bits of work around the well-being and social connectedness that then can work in with our bricks and mortar bit. And between us, we can then provide that holistic response to some pretty complicated veteran needs, veteran areas of veteran need.
It's a very complex issue, isn't it? And obviously, RSL Care South Australia has been very flexible in their approach to it. Let's go to something really, really simple, Nathan. As simple as telling the story or recounting a story from their lives. On Service Voices, we find invariably we get so many comments from families of men and women that we interview saying, that has been so therapeutic for him or her to be able to sit down and tell his or her story.
Absolutely.
Do you allow that to happen in the aged care facilities, or does it happen?
I'll allow it. We actively seek it.
Encourage it.
We love it. And it adds as much value and character to us as an organisation as for the residents' benefit. So what we've actually done is we've developed a care model called the Janus approach. Janus was the god of transitions, often represented by an older face looking forward and a younger face looking back, a two-faced god. And that younger looking back, older looking forward, we found is a really useful analogy for how we see. We're all on a point in time, but it's not the just old or just young, we're all on a spectrum. So with our Janus approach to how we deliver our care, central to that is the dignity of care that we provide to all residents, veteran or not. Now, if we are truly going to provide care that is dignity and resident focused, we have to understand what the resident wants. What you want out of your care is different to what I might want out of mine. What a veteran who's been a farmer for 50 years wants out of his care might be very different to a lady who ran a business in town. Different experiences, different histories, different goals, different outcomes. So there is an absolutely critical element to understanding the individual residents and understanding who they are, what's important to them. You know, we could provide the best wine at dinner, which I'd love, So that'd be a big thing for me, nice wine at dinner. But if you're a teetotaler as a resident, that adds no value to your life at all. So we can't say, well, we give everyone good wine. Why aren't they happy? Well, she doesn't drink. So that's not important to her. You know, what is important to her is to have these other things in her life. She might be an artist, so she loves to be surrounded by art and art products. Well, okay, well, I'm not an artist. That doesn't float my boat. So it's really about understanding what is important to the residents. And for us, and you've mentioned that critical role that being able to talk about a serviceman or woman's history and the importance for the families to be able to talk about that and share in that knowledge. So we've developed a very detailed resident history that we look to take when a resident moves in with us, moves into their home, that's their home. And it's not something we do on admission day only. You know, we meet them, we greet them, we chat, we get some basic history. But it's actually a conversation that evolves probably over the next 3 months. Revisit stories, we hear, we listen, we ask questions, we look to understand. And we look to capture, in particular, our mission and objects, a lot of that military history understanding, because we understand the difference between the Air Force, the Navy and the Army. We understand the difference between being a pilot officer and being ground crew. We understand what it means to be a warrant officer versus a major. You know, all these bits that are all really important, none of them are more or less important than any other aspect, but we can actually draw value out of that history that then helps in terms of how we may interact with a veteran. We'll ask a veteran about what are the milestone dates that are important to them. Because to society, we've got Anzac Day and Remembrance Day, and increasingly Long Tan Day. That's great. Well, that's a no-brainer. But for a veteran, they'll have a dozen dates in a year that are important. It might be their discharge date, might be important. It might be the date of a significant battle for their unit, which was only a really small battle that no one else knows about, but they lost two of their mates in it. It may be the day they enlisted. It may be the day they deployed. It may be something to do in their history that's important to them. It may be something that a mate of theirs did that they weren't even there with. But it's us understanding all those little nuances of their history so that we don't treat all veterans the same. We don't drag all Vietnam vets out for Vietnam Vet Day. Because we've got a couple that don't want to go. And you know what? That's fine. How would you like to? Well, I'd like to stay at home. I'd like to have a beer. I'd like to have a bit of a quiet time with a couple of mates. Great. You don't need to go in town and march. If that's what you'd like to do, let's help you do that. But you've got to ask the questions. You've got to have those conversations, meaningful conversations, not just a tick and flick. You've actually got to sit down and get to know the veterans and what's important to them. Sometimes the veterans themselves will struggle to articulate that. We've had veterans, one in particular, who told me black and blue that he wouldn't go to Anzac Day. I've never been to one Vietnam vet, I wouldn't go to one. But as our conversation has evolved and we found a lot of value in his service, he came to find that same value and more so in his service. We were able to take some experience that he had in the service and use that experience in the residential care facility with some of the committees that we had. We said, mate, you used to do this. That'd be really helpful to join a committee and bring that experience. And he's now one of our greatest advocates in terms of veteran well-being. He always attends our dawn services with us, proudly wears his medals. That wasn't a goal for us to get him to do that. If he didn't want to do that, that's fine. Don't go to Anzac Day, mate. You don't have to. Don't wear your medals. But through the process of us learning about each other and having those conversations, it really opened up a part of his life that he'd closed down during his working life. Because for him, returning from Vietnam and then leaving the military wasn't a particularly positive experience. And so he kind of put that in a bottom drawer and left it there. He then opened that bottom drawer through the conversations that he had with us. And that's such a beautiful thing to be able to be involved in that and to take part in that and to be as much a recipient in that as he was. One of my favourite photos with another work colleague of mine, Nick, who's also a veteran, and this resident. So the three of us on that first Anzac Day that we all got to do together. Absolutely one of my favourite photos of all time. That'll stay with me for life. It's just beautiful.
Nathan, do you like the job that you do?
Don't like it? Love it.
I thought so. Nathan Kling, thank you very much for talking with Service Voices today.
Thanks, Helen. My pleasure.